So let me first summarize, of course, because not everybody was here last time. So that's a discussion about resummation and renormalization. For gauge series. And I will stick to so-called self-consistent resummation. I mean NPI kind of resummation. So last time I said words about these two parts. Last week I had started this discussion, and the main part was the last part, so you're here for this today. I just want to summarize these 2 points for those who weren't there. So I'll be mainly talking about the 2PI resummation scheme. We define a 2PI functional, which I will describe again for gauge theories in a moment, so I don't say other thing about this. I mean, let me just say the words. It's just a generalization of what we usually do in field theory. You couple a linear field to the field, and you take derivative with respect to the source to get your correlation functions. Here, you just put another source for which is bilinear in the field, and by taking functional derivative with respect to this other source, you have another way to generate your correlation function. As usual, you can do a Lejeune transform to go from this generating functional to an effective action. Here you have two sources, you can do two Lejeune transform and you get this this beast, 2PI effective action, from which you get physics by taking minimum. So this is a 2-point function, this is a 1-point function, and this is a 2-point function, which at the end will the physical one will be the two-point function of the theory. When solving this equation, which is nothing but the Schwinger-Dyson equation for a given G, which I call G bar, the solution of this equation, if I plug back G bar in this expression, I get the usual effective action. And the non-trivial point about this equation is when one does truncations. So if you truncate, if you try to compute this, say, in perturbative way and truncate somewhere, or if you try to compute this guy in perturbative way, I mean, coupling extension, one over n extension, anything else, then solve for G bar, put it back here, and get a result, you get two different, very different approach. So this second approach is called the 2PI resummation scheme. It resums non-perturbatively higher orders in usual perturbation theory. It can be improved systematically, so it's a non-perturbative scheme which can be systematically improved just by getting better and better approximation to the starting point here. Okay, that's the summary for this part. Another word which I will need. Of course, from this object now, if I just, you know, give you this, I don't tell you where I got it from. Yeah. What you would do is to get the endpoint function from it by taking functional derivatives. Yeah. In particular, you could take two functional derivatives and you would get the 2-point function. And you would expect that if now I tell you where I got this from, here, you would expect that the 2-point function you get from here, the gamma 2, so you derive twice with respect to phi, should be the same as the 2-point function here. It's true for the exact theory, it's true for some approximation, but in general it's not true when you truncate, and that's one of the big points here. And this is related to the fact that to generate our correlation function from the very start, we had these two sources possible. So we can either differentiate with respect to one or the other, and we have two ways of generating endpoint function.
Sorry, but the difference would be higher order.
And the difference, if you're systematic in your approximation scheme, you're guaranteed that the difference is always higher order than your truncation order. Yeah. All right, so yeah.
Go again for the benefits of people who are not here. So you're talking about field theory as some of those schemes?
It could be Fermat, it could be non-equilibrium, vacuum. For the moment, I don't have to restrict myself to state.
Now, is there some physical? So you said that this scheme can be consistently improved. But is there some physical way to phrase in which, you know, what is this approximation? I'm thinking in terms of, I don't know, some small derivatives, or you know, or
you could, in principle, you could do anything you like here. Yeah. I mean, you could try to approximate this object by a loop expansion, a 1 over n expansion, a gradient expansion, a field expansion. It's not your question, okay?
Well, I mean, he asked for a small exponent for omega. In general, without having a physical application in mind, there is none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
that's... I mean, saying systematic, everybody uses this word, buzzword, systematic in a different way. It just means if you want to have, for instance, that you can normalize theory by a finite set of counterterms, mm-hmm. and you make a loop expansion, you shouldn't use one loop and five loop, and leave out two loop, three loop, four loop. Mm-hmm. Then you wouldn't find that you can like finitize it by the number of counterterms. So if you do a loop expansion, stick to a loop expansion. If you do a coupling expansion, stick to a coupling expansion. If you do a 1 over n expansion, stick to 1 over n expansion. Resummed in this two guys, then you can be sure that you can renormalize the theory, and you can be sure that you recover this, you know, water entities which shows.
I guess my question was a little bit different. Is there a way to see, so you formulate your effective action in terms of, you know, 1-point function and 2-point, mm-hmm. 2-point correlation function, right? What's special about this scheme? Why not 1 and 3 or 1 and 4?
All right. This what's special about this one is that it's the first one beyond one and nothing.
Okay.
One and nothing just doesn't work for there are specific situations, like, I mean, the basic one is go far from equilibrium, and one and nothing will not work.
But is there some physical way to see when I see that's so somehow you wanna treat in some sense exactly the 2-point correlation?
Somehow, I mean, at this level, it's just parameterizing the theory in a different way, as usual. I don't miss any information there.
There is actually no general answer to this, there's a partial answer to this.
No, there's no general answer.
You want to do the perfect job and say, you call something completely self-consistent, that you go to NPI, where n goes to infinity. Mm-hmm. So not just 1-point function, 2-point function, but infinite whole function as well. And then you ask your question. You do a loop expansion to 3-loop order. Is there a difference between 3pi and npi where n goes to infinity? Mm-hmm. The answer is no. Mm-hmm. If you go to 4-loop order, is there a difference between 4pi and npi? The answer is no. There's no difference between 4pi and 5pi. So going to lower pi, you may think of that this is relevant at low order loop expansion. Otherwise, you may want to go to npi with completely self.
Can we make this more precise? Namely, what order corresponds to, I mean, just what you said, but in kind of in formal-like way.
I mean, this statement I just made, this hierarchy that infinite pi corresponds to 3pi, mm-hmm. for a given order of loops, mm-hmm. that you can make precise. Mm-hmm. If this really tells you something about physical applications, it's another thing.
If you
want to be complete,
the emphasis on the 2-point function is the
decision to go to 2pi if you go to low orders.
So here, there is. I mean, just a remark is that, I mean, it's not that you miss higher correlation function, of course.
Yes.
They are just parametrized by this.
Parametrized in a different way. And
somehow you have to truncate.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that you miss a higher correlation function. All right, let me go on. So that's the summary about resummation. I unfortunately don't have time to go beyond this. renormalization, to summarize. what I tried to argue last time is that this non-perturbative approximation, I showed you that, you know, we resum some class of diagrams and that they come with their divergences, and we should be able to have for each diagram the relevant diagram with counter terms to absorb the divergence at any order, etc., etc. And what I argued last time is that indeed, if you include properly counter terms from the start here, the resummation scheme, I mean this, let's call this the resummation equation, this is where the main resummation is encoded, this will generate the all the graph you resum with their divergences, but if you put it here, the correct counter terms, this would also generate all the graph with the relevant counter terms. And the net result of that is that all your equation can be made finite, all your endpoint function can be made finite with this self-consistently. What you have to do is to include all local. That's the same result as usual, but for this beast, all local counter terms. Consistent with symmetry. For instance, for phi to the 4 theory, so if in the action we have the interaction part is phi to the 4, that's, I draw that as this vertex, the effective action is the action plus, I mean, it can be parametrized like this, plus other stuff. And the first diagrams one has with this contribution is, for instance, this stuff. And we also had a diagram like this, where this represents the field. The line represents the two-point function G. So these are possible diagrams. And to this, which is the bare theory, if you wish, if I want to make any approximation finite, I should add a set of counter terms, which in that case was, for instance, I needed a counter term here, a counter term there, and other counter terms. The point was that the counter term I had to put here, I called it delta lambda 0, might be different from the counter term I have to put there at a given approximation order, just because they have to absorb different divergences. And these different divergences are related to the fact that you have different way to access same correlation function. So I can access the two-point correlation, I can compute the two-point correlation function G bar. I can also compute another approximation to it, which is gamma 2, at a given approximation order. Of course, if they differ, for some general approximation they differ, the divergence differ as well, and I will need different counter terms to renormalize them. Okay, the same for the four-point functions. That's why one needs different counter terms, but the point is that these counter terms can be different. No symmetry impose them to be the same. Of course, if you go to high approximation order, the difference between these counter terms decrease with is higher than the approximation order. At the end of the day, if you resum everything, if you would be able to do that, they tend to the same value, which is the one coupling counter term of the theory. All right. Okay, so that's the summary. And now I come to the today's point, gauge theories. So I want to discuss some aspects of this problem, because it's I don't have time to discuss everything, and again to give you some ideas of how it works, and the details can be found in the literature. No time to present this on the blackboard. So the main point is here. I want to do the I want basically, I mean, I will do abelian gauge theories for today. And okay, QED, typically. So what I want to do is to be able to compute with such methods in, say, QED. Yeah, I want to just put down some equations and get physical results from this. Of course, to get reliable quantities, I will have to renormalize. And I want to know where should I put counter terms, how do I fix them, what do they do, how do I do the renormalization program for a given approximation, 2pi approximation in QED. So the main issue here is symmetries. Already with the 1pi, the usual stuff, we know that the gauge symmetry plays a crucial role, yeah, for the theory to be renormalizable. The same is true here. What I want to show to you is that the symmetry requirement, the symmetry constraints that the 2pi effective action has to satisfy are special to the 2pi effective action. Yeah, there is often a confusion. One asks the 1pi, the 2pi effective action to satisfy the usual world identity. And this leads to some confusion. Yeah. What I want to argue here is that this guy has, of course, its own world identities, and then when we understand this, we can just analyze the divergences, see what we get here, and what we will get is that all the counter terms consistent with these symmetries will be allowed to appear. So let me start with QED. Of course, I have to fix the gauge. So I have some fermions. Okay, then let me take this, writing it, just to fix things. And that's it. Oh no, that's not it. I have to, the gauge fixing is there. I mean, this lambda is one of the xi, the gauge fixing parameter. Yeah, the charge, the fermion mass, etc., etc. This has a symmetry which, you change the phase, so it's local. I don't try the dependence. And you change the field accordingly. It goes to, I think, something like this, where alpha is a real function. The question I want to ask myself now is, this symmetry, I mean, of course, the gauge fixing term is not invariant, only the non-gauge fixing part is invariant. How does this translate to to the 2pi effective action? Just making a comment here because I saw this. When we introduce bilinear sources in that case, we would write a generating functional with many sources here, like linear and bilinear sources, and this would be I sum over all my fields, exponential, the action, and we put sources JA plus something like this, not that. Just the comment is usually what we see is that you basically put the bilinear sources. How is it? Psi bar psi, some sources, let me call it like this, and you put another source for the A. Okay. I just want to point out that this, if I now Legendre transform with respect to this 1 point and 2 point sources, this is not the 2pi effective action for QED. This will be 2pi with respect to cutting two fermion lines or two photon lines, but not with respect to cutting a fermion line and a photon line. If I want to have the full 2pi stuff, I need to put mixed sources, like psi bar A, Ka psi bar. Okay, that's just a remark, and we can discuss that any other time. So, just to fix the formulation, I need all the sources. So it's convenient to introduce a super field. I write it like this, so it's the four component of this guy, and the four component of this guy, the four component of this guy, just write it as a super field. I will have a super propagator, which will be the photon propagator. Then, I mean, I have to define some mixed things, so just be nice with me and, you know, this is not the same as this. Okay, this is the source, this is the propagator, and I realized I used the same stuff, and I don't change this. So, I mean, just to be clean, I write this like that. So I have to introduce various correlators. This transpose, if you want to be precise, has to be a transposition in Dirac and space-time indices. For instance, the inverse free propagator in this language will be, let me, okay, GAA, put it like this. That's the usual Dirac operator, and something similar here. It contains, I mean, the transpose of it with some signs. I don't have it correct here. So written in this way, what I can do is to introduce, okay, this is my source now, let me call it R, maybe, RG people. Okay, and then, okay, I have, so this now is a sum over all these possible sources, and I just have something like this, a bilinear sources. Yeah. So in principle, I would have to worry about signs and, you know, Grassmann variables and things like this. I won't at all do it here. One can do it. You have to define left derivatives, right derivatives, things like this. I mean, this is all taking care of signs, and this is really not the point here. Yeah.
You put that form of the inverse propagator just because it's because you read it from the classical action.
Yeah.
So that will be the classical.
This is the free.
The
free. So it's a D0, yeah, everywhere. It's this is really a D slash minus M, and this is what you read from this free guy. So where is my symmetry discussion? Okay, now I want to exploit the symmetry for this guy here. The symmetry is a linear one, so I will do an infinitesimal symmetry transformation. I will go to a delta phi, which is supposed to be small, and this stuff for this symmetry, but what I will say is more general, is a linear transformation. So it's a matrix, it's not the same A, you see it's a curly one, A phi plus some B. I mean, basically, A is just this, you know, a matrix in superfield space, which bring a phase to this guy, the other, the complex, the conjugate phase to this guy, nobody to him, and this B is brings nothing to this guy and just the affine theorem to A. Okay, so I can write this transformation like this. If I my action is as a gauge invariant part by definition, and the change in the action is just the change in the gauge fixing part. Yeah, so only the gauge fixing part, this term is changed. What I can do from here is the usual manipulation, which I won't do now. But you change under the integral, you can change the variable from this to this one. Yeah. The action you can rewrite in terms of the old variable, the change is just due to this. And here the phi will be a phi plus delta phi. You can rewrite as the original guy. Should I do that? No. Oh. The basic result that you have, I mean, then you have, you know, the same integral with shifted phi. The shifted phi is supposed to be small, so you look at linear order, and it tells you that basically sum of a phi I to the very same thing times the change, the variation of this, which is the change of the gauge fixing term, plus j times the change of phi, plus r times the linear change of this, which is phi delta phi. And the two is because you can do it twice. And this is higher order in delta phi. This should be zero, and this is the this is the quantum expression of the symmetry. So I can replace this integral here by an average. Yeah, I can rewrite this as by saying I take the average of this stuff at linear order, and this is zero. So that's my world identity, if you wish. All right. Now I want to exploit this and write it as a world identity for the 2pi effective action. And for this, I just recall some equations from the Legendre transform. I have to recall you that this is a J. This stuff I call this. This stuff the one-point function, and that's the connected two-point function. And when I do it, I define gamma phi and g as the double Legendre transform of this with respect to this variable. What comes out from this is that I can it's something like this. I mean, it's exactly this. All right, so using this, I can express J and R in terms of derivative of the 2pi effective action. And what you get from this equation is the following. You get that delta gamma 2pi delta phi times, you see this term, for instance, J will give delta gamma delta phi times the average of delta phi, okay? This is this term. When you work out the other terms, there are some stuff which cancels and other which stays. And what you have here is the phi delta phi plus delta phi phi connected piece equals to this, the average. All right, so for that's very general, yeah. Now for linear transformation, this delta phi is nothing else but delta of the average. The average of the change is the change of the average, and it's just my matrix A times my macroscopic field, if you wish, plus the same matrix B as I had here. This is nothing else but the change that linear order in the connected part of the two-point function. So it's just delta G. All right, so this is just expressing the fact that when this equation is just telling me this. If I would have a symmetry, this would be zero, and this would tell me that the effective action has to be symmetric under this transformation. Yeah. Now I don't have a symmetry, I have this gauge fixing term. For abelian gauge theory with linear gauge fixing, as I used, linear gauge fixing means that the gauge fixing action is quadratic in A. All right? So A's gauge fixing is quadratic in A. The change delta S gauge fixing is linear in A. What do I mean by that? Delta A. A times delta A. No? Yeah, A times delta A. And the delta A is independent of the field, okay, because it's a purely affine transformation. This won't be true anymore for non-abelian theory. Which means that, this is field independent, so when I take the average of this, this is also this, because this is a number, say, and I can write this as delta S gauge fixing over delta phi times delta phi for abelian gauge theories. So this is just, I can write it like this. All right, the gauge fixing action does not depend on G, so I can rewrite this whole equation as, if I derive with respect to phi this operator acting on gamma 2 pi . Okay, that's my word identity, and this guy are the one I obtained by symmetry, of course. It's A phi plus B, and this one, you can easily convince yourself that since you look at the connected part, the affine part of the transformation disappears completely. Okay, so this delta G is A times G plus G times A. All right. There's no contribution from the affine part here because it's the connected guy. So that's my 2pi word identity. Yeah. And this tells me that if I take this object, this combination, and change phi from phi to delta phi with delta phi this, and g from g to delta g with delta g this, this stuff doesn't change. Okay? So it tells me that this object is gauge invariant in that sense, where I call this a gauge transformation of the argument here.
In some sense, it seems to imply that if the classical action has a symmetry, the
top direction
has the same symmetry, but that doesn't sound right.
But it is. Sorry?
You can have anomalies.
Of course, yeah. This all assumes no anomalies. So the measure here is must be an invariant.
Because you can have anomalies in.
Or if you have anomalies, then you should resync all this. Mm-hmm. If you have anomalies, yeah, you should resync.
But because QED is limited.
Abelian
QED, so there is no.
Oh, so this is only for QED. That's the point.
This is abelian gauge theory now.
Only in
QED. Sorry.
No anomalies.
Yeah, I don't have anomalies. Yeah, I'm not sure. All right. So the point.
That word identity would be much more complicated.
Oh yeah.
You said
It would.
Is it possible to generalize non-linearity?
Okay, let's forgetting about anomalies. Just trying to get through this. Where are the difficulties? I mean, they are at the same place as usual. I can't write this, for instance. Okay, just because here delta A would depend on A, and this would involve the two-point function. Okay, I could write something, but I would not be able to solve it. Here I can solve it by saying, you know, this is just a gauge invariant object. This is the answer. Here I could not conclude like this. So what one usually does with non-abelian theories is not to look for the original gauge symmetry, but for the BRS transformation, which is a symmetry of the theory. That is, this is zero instead of. But now the price to pay is that this is not a linear transformation anymore, and basically you don't know what this is in terms of phi and g. Yeah, so it becomes dynamical if you wish, and you have to compute it, and again, it's difficult to do.
But for a given location, you can write
all expressions. Yeah, but then you would, I think, not be able for a given gauge to check that this satisfies your identity. That you're trying. I mean, then the difficult thing would be to find truncations which actually satisfy what you wrote here. Because what you wrote here would have a sense only for G solution of, you know, it really becomes dynamical.
A comfort story would always plug it in what you can check when they spoil something.
Yeah, you can do that. But usually, I think you would not find that it respects your symmetry. At least for approximation, I know it's. I mean, to find truncation which respect the BRS symmetry is not easy.
Yes,
I don't think so. I mean,
check.
No, I know nothing.
What do you mean?
So I will say something for truncation. I mean, all this, of course, I did not do any truncation, so I will now speak about truncations. All right, what should I erase? Everything. Yeah, so this tells me that gamma 2pi phi g minus s gauge fixing phi is a gauge invariant. By this I mean invariant under phi goes to phi plus a phi plus b. And g goes to g plus a g plus g a. I mean, this is supposed to be a matrix product. It doesn't come. All right. So now I have to skip a lot of things, and I have to choose what to skip. So yeah, let me try to exploit this. For the moment, it's very formal, yeah. And I want to know what this tells me about endpoint function of the theory, yeah. Really, the word identity. So the first remark, the very simple remark I want to do here, is that suppose now I put the source k, the r to zero, yeah, the one which makes the difference between 1pi formalism and 2pi formalism in the exact theory. I put this to zero. It tells me. Basically, I solve for g, yeah, this equals zero. So I solve for g bar of phi, all right? If I solve for g bar of phi, this delta gamma 2pi delta g is zero. Yeah, and what I get from this is nothing but delta phi, delta over delta phi of gamma minus s gauge fixing phi equals zero, where this guy is really gamma 2pi phi g bar and phi. So the 2pi recent effective action. What does this tell me is that the 2pi recent effective action, yeah, whatever the scheme you got it, is gauge invariant apart from the classical gauge fixing term. Yeah, that's the usual result, the usual thing everybody knows. Which, by the way, tells me that, for instance, the photon polarization tensor is transverse, etc., etc. Okay, this is nothing but a statement of the usual water for gamma. This sounds trivial, but it is not. You know, now what this contains is that if now to approximation, because this is the whole point. If I can find an approximation which has this property, yeah, everything I'm saying now following from this equation will be true. In particular, the non-perturbatively resummed 2pi resummed effective action will be gauge invariant and will satisfy all the usual world identities. Also, it contains resummation in every direction. Yeah. It's very different from the perturbative expansion what I get here, but it will satisfy all the world identities.
What's that?
It's just a consequence of the thing.
That means any other contribution to that gamma, which is not 2pi, it's also itself gauge invariant. Gamma contains things that are further than just that gamma 2pi, right?
Gamma contains...
All the perturbative expansion. When in 2pi, you just have resummed.
Yeah, but this guy as well. I mean, this guy contains resumming perturbative diagrams with a given topology, infinitely many, but leaving out many others. Yeah, so it's very non-trivial that this guy will satisfy at any truncation order I can do it here the word identities. I will argue that any truncation in QED is gauge invariant. Any. It's particular to QED. In scalar QED, you would have to sum diagrams to get gauge invariant approximation, but it can be done. I can build systematic gauge invariant truncation in Abelian gauge theory, 2pi. All right, so that's a way to see that all the endpoint function I will construct from this 2pi resummed effective action will, if I know how to construct a gauge invariant guy here, truncation order, they will satisfy all the usual identities. Photon polarization tensor obtained from this second derivative with respect to A will be transverse. The relation between the vertex obtained from here and the fermion propagator obtained from here, the usual relation between vertex and propagator, will be true. Although these objects contain many resummations. All right, but there's much more than this to say. What about other correlation functions? What about G-bar? You know, the solution of this minimization equation when I put R to zero. What about other correlation function that I can obtain not from this but from this by taking derivative respect to G, to phi, etc., etc.? So what about what I would call 2pi world identities? Just to name them differently as the usual one. Yeah. Well, the first thing one can say is, the first remark one can say, is here. You see, the symmetry of the underlying theory tells me that this guy has also a symmetry. But look what happens when I do this. When I do this, the B, which was the transformation of the photon field, yeah, disappears because I am looking at a connected part of the two-point function. I mean by that, if I just look at what is the change in the fermion propagator, say, The fermion propagator, you know, it's roughly speaking psi bar psi y with t products and anything you like. The change in here will be the change of this guy and the change of this guy. So it will have I alpha of x and dxy coming from the change of phase here minus dxy times I alpha of y, yeah, which is this. What about the change in the photon propagator, g mu nu? Well, g mu nu is a nu connected. Yeah, I don't have time to do this elementary calculation, but you can check that this is zero. And this just tells you that there's no contribution from B here. Okay? So that's an interesting point, which tells us that this guy has to be gauge invariant under, I mean, gauge invariant, meaning this invariant under this transformation. This transformation happens not to do anything on the photon propagator. Doesn't change it. Yeah? So, of course, I can, from this, I can already see that, you know, I can do whatever I want. When I will solve for g bar here, when I will go for g bar of phi, that's the super propagator. In there is even a g bar mu nu of a psi psi bar for arbitrary field. This guy will never be constrained by symmetry. It cannot be constrained by symmetry because the symmetry does just not talk to it. Okay? So the consequence is that the pi, the photon polarization tensor I can get from this, can be anything. No constraint. And it's well known in this business that this guy for typical truncation is not transverse. Okay? This has been a big point of saying, you know, you get a non-transverse answer, it breaks gauge invariance. The point is that you get a non-transverse answer, but it doesn't break the gauge invariance. Yeah? It's just because this object is now obtained by different route as the one you got from two derivative from here. This one, it's a geometrical argument that it has to be transverse. Yeah, it's a derivative of something. This one, no. It's the minimum of a function. No constraint at all. Okay, so we should not jump and say, wow, it's not transverse. He has no reason to be transverse. The only reason he has to be transverse is that when you go to the exact theory, this guy and this guy should agree. And since this one is transverse, this one will be transverse. But I mean, for this guy to be transverse, you need two things. The symmetry and the exact theory.
This exact theory means, in the case of Orem theory, that the symmetry doesn't constrain
exactly. Exactly. There is a similar thing when you don't do gauge theory, but you do On in the broken phase. It's known that the guy you get from this minimization equation usually have no Goldstone pole. I mean, he has a non-zero mass, which is higher order than the truncation order. This can always be checked, shown. But he has no strictly pole at a Goldstone pole. Yeah, and this is just for the very same reason. Right. So that was one of the remarks I wanted to make. Another...
Yeah. How about physical information? What physical information can you extract from these things? You know, so for example, does a pole tell you anything about physical things happening?
The pole of this guy. I mean, the physical information you would extract from this is the same as usual. It's just that since now your approximation scheme, which is a bit different from the one you had before, this approximation scheme does not somehow guarantee you that it's going to be transverse, you'll find some non-transverse part, which, of course, are unphysical somehow. But, I mean, there are their presence is just saying you made an approximation. So the question is, do these Goldstone pole or non-pole or this non-transverse part, are they under control? Can we understand them? Yeah. And the answer I will have not time to develop here is yes, we can actually.
If any sort of physical information about, say, some quasi particle in whatever, some plasma, right, can I use this formalism regardless of the fact that I know that this is not a physical thing?
Oh, it is a physical thing.
The thing is not transverse, right?
Yeah, I mean, but what I will perhaps argue is that the non-transverse contribution to it is higher order than your truncation order. Always. So if you go to 2pi approximation at order e squared, you know, for the 2pi functional, you truncate at order e squared, you know that the non-transversality is e4. You go to e4, this guy go to e6, etc. He's pushed. Okay, so it's really an artifact of the truncation.
So you can extract everything else, you can just ignore because you know that.
Exactly, you can extract physical information just as you could just as you can extract physical information from here. Very same, the pole, the width.
If you take the second derivative of the
fact that
it will be
yeah, somehow it tells you that if the thing you want to compute is
higher order.
So just a second, that this thing contains some piece which is an artifact of this particular scheme.
Yeah, exactly.
At the given order, we can ignore this.
Sometimes you can, sometimes you cannot. I mean, when you will put this on the computer will just put you everything. You are not able to say this is higher order. So it will be there. But the question is, can I control it? If now you can, you know, do more analytical work with this, like computing transport coefficients where you can isolate the part which you're interested in, then you can really identify the non-transverse part of this, throw it away consistently, and yes. But I mean, for example, for non-equilibrium physics, you will typically put this on the computer, and then the computer just gives you the answer, the full stuff. So within truncation errors, it will be at the correct place. I mean, you did an approximation, so you should not expect more than an approximated result, and that's what you get.
I mean, there is a way. You just take the derivative of the action. Mm-hmm. So you have two objects that you can might call the self energy. Analytically, it doesn't matter. The pi bar you can chop off the higher order function. It's a different expression, but essentially what it does for you is chopping off this.
It's everything more false in this case.
If you wait long enough, yeah, you'll find a pole somewhere.
Well, usually you don't ask for poles, you would ask for poles.
Exactly, it's not the question you would ask, but I mean the presence or not of this pole will somehow, I mean, you could, you know, see its influence or not.
When you do it numerically, you do it
in fact, I mean, it depends. For non-equilibrium physics, it's much easier to get this one. And this one, you can get, okay, this one. But it's more difficult to attain it.
You can't get critical exponents, you know, when theory near the phase transition. You don't want to use this pi bar. So what you have to do to really extract the exponents in any reasonable way on a computer, you calculate the pi, and then you can do exponents. So it's true that in these intermediate steps, you seem to have loop expressions with propagators that have a mass in there. Nevertheless, you can extract critical exponents, which obviously are infrared quantities. It's like regulating theory and intermediate steps of your calculation and
being regulated. Somehow. Yeah. I mean, okay, there's another thing to this, it's the gauge fixing parameter dependence. Yeah, which I will, now I said the word, you have to wait for the answer, so I can't say anything. I just want to say before that, a few other points. The reason for this, I mean, here I said this is not constrained because the transformation does not affect it. But the reason is even deeper. I mean, it's just not constrained because this is the, you know, the symmetry in theory constrain the field dependence. Yeah? So it tells you if you are there in 5G space, and if you want to do, you know, a small step in that direction, if you take this direction, it doesn't change. So it tells you. But if you look for the minimum of this guy, it cannot be constrained by symmetry. Only the field dependence is constrained. And this is the minimum. So this guy will not be constrained, and this will not be constrainable also by symmetry. Yeah, I mean the D bar. What, however, will be constrained is the field dependence of this guy. Yeah? And that's an interesting thing. So it's a very short point, and I think it's interesting. I was amazed to find this. So G bar of phi is the, let me call this the minimum, although, I mean, this an extremum of gamma phi G in G space. Well, what about, oh yeah, now I use gauge invariance. Gamma phi of G bar by gauge invariance. I mean, yeah, gamma sim, I call gamma sim this functional because it's the one which is symmetric. Yeah, the difference. This stuff is symmetric, so by gauge invariance, this is the same as gamma sin, phi plus delta phi, g bar phi, plus delta g bar phi, where this is the gauge transform of g bar phi, right? But g bar is the minimum of gamma phi g, which, I mean, this also tells me that g bar of phi plus delta phi is the minimum of gamma phi plus delta phi g in g space. If I take this at phi plus delta phi, find the minimum, it's by definition g bar of phi plus delta phi. All right. But these two equations imply that this is the same as this. Right? So if I now write this as g plus delta phi delta g bar over delta phi, I linearize it, I get that the field dependence of G bar is constrained, and if I vary the field if I do a gauge transformation of the argument, the stuff should transform. This delta G being this delta phi is now the same as before, and this delta G is A G bar plus G bar A. Yeah. And this equation tells me that if I do a change of a gauge transformation of the argument of G bar transform covariantly. Right. But the nice point to this is that in the same way, G bar is the two-point function of the theory. Yeah, it's related to gamma 2. Second derivative. If I take another derivative of gamma 2, I get gamma 3, and another gamma 4, etc., etc. So you understand that if I take a derivative of G bar, I mean G bar inverse, in fact, if I take a derivative of G bar, it's another approximation to the three-point function. If I take two derivatives of G bar, it's the four-point function in the exact theory. So this gives me 2pi kind of word identities for these other way of computing 3, 4, and 5 point functions. All right? Nice thing about them, if I look at the AA part of this equation, we saw that this is zero. It doesn't change in the, I mean, this change is zero. Yeah, the connected part doesn't change. So now, this should be seen as a sum, like delta A, delta GAA, delta A plus delta psi times the rest. This delta A is, you know, it was 1 over E, d mu alpha, and we have to put a mu here. This psi is a linear transformation, so it's alpha times psi. When I put the field to their physical value, like psi equals 0, etc., all the rest is 0. And I get that, for instance, as an application of this, I get that this equals 0. If I go to Fourier space, this tells me that k mu times this function equals 0. What is this function? As I told you, it's a kind of a, for those who remember my diagrammatic notation of last week, very strong, it's an approximation of the three-photon function. What I'm telling you is that if you contract a K with this line, it's a transverse guy, which is the usual one identity. If you now take two derivatives, you get the same result. So if you take many derivatives, there are this object, which is the 2pi 3, 4, 5 photon point function, is transverse with respect to any of these lines, not with respect to these, which is a sign of this was not constrained, but it is transverse with respect to all the other lines. If you would play the same game with, you know, the psi bar part of this equation, of the superpropagator, and take just the, you know, this is the delta D, what I wrote before, so it involves D minus D, and this would be something like I psi bar, so this is a fermion line, and I derive with respect to A. This would be a resummed, I mean, fully resummed three-point vertex of the theory. Yeah, if you just plug in everything correctly, what you find is that this object, let me call it, I don't know, V mu of P, K, where I think it's like this P and K, you find that this object, which is delta of, related to delta of the inverse propagator with respect to A. So this means you solve for the, you take a 2pi truncation, you solve for D for arbitrary fields, yeah, and you take a derivative with respect to A, right? This gives you the three-point function without going to this 2pi resumption. It turns out that this satisfy the usual Wahl identity, which I write, I mean, quickly like this. And in fact, it's easy to show that these are just the usual Wahl identities for 2pi vertices, for 2pi resum function. Not 2pi resum in that sense, but for function which you obtain by taking this derivative. Yeah? So there are a lot of, you know, new Wahl identities. It turns out that there is a whole series of endpoint functions, you know, which are obtained by derivatives of G bar, which satisfy just the usual Wahl identities. All right. The only one which doesn't is G bar itself. Okay, that's it for symmetries. And I will take 1 minute to say a word about renormalization now that we know all this, if you don't mind. Because this was the point. suppose I, for my 2PI effective action, I will just exemplify what happens with the simplest truncation. This one. So the two-loop truncation. In general, you have to introduce to include also this mixed kind of object. So there are other two-loop terms, but for what I will say, they don't play any role. So from this, you get by taking a derivative with respect to d, which is the fermion propagator, you get the self-energy for the fermion. Let me call it sigma bar. And diagrammatically, this will be something like this, at this order. The pi bar, so I take a derivative with respect to g, will just at this order look like this. Where the lines are the full guides. Huh? This is g bar, the full one, which is recent everything. This is d bar, and here as well. All right. So the question of renormalization was, there are divergences in these resummation equations, yeah? And to see what are the divergences, I have to re-expand in terms not of G bar, but in terms of the class, the free propagator, just to see where are divergences, yeah? Okay, so if I just take which one? This one, for instance, I expand it again, yeah? For instance, this fermion line, I can include a self-energy insertion, right? So there is, at leading order, this is D0, the free guy. So I have this. Then at next order, when I include such this stuff self-consistently in this line, I will have a contribution like this. And then I have other contribution, like I include two of them. Or I can, you know, put another self-energy insertion there. So this kind of thing I resum, where this is now all perturbative diagram. So the problem is very easy to see now. This has a divergence here. This is the very same as you have in perturbation theory. It's renormalized by the very same counter term, which in that case is a wave function renormalization for the photon field. Yeah. Next thing is here. Here we have this, we have there is an integral, like I can draw it like this, where every line which I cut is fixed. And this loop goes to infinity. This gives a divergence, which is a coupling-like divergence. It has four external photon legs. If I would like to absorb this divergence, I would need a four photon vertex. Okay, that's bad. Usually in perturbation theory, I have this term as well. Yeah? Here it's not there, and this term, what does it do? If I just fix this line, there is also a divergence, a four-point function divergence. The sum of these two diagrams, however, is transverse. And this, if you then analyze, guarantees that there are four photon divergences. They just cancel. Here I don't have this. This would come from the next order. This would come from the next order in propagation. I don't have it. Yeah. I don't have it. It's just a manifestation of the fact that the guy I have here is not transverse. You know, I have non-transverse contribution starting here at order E4, as I said before. They start at next. Yeah? But it also means that I will need a photon counterterm to absorb this. And moreover, I also have now, you know, a two-point divergence. Usually, when this guy is transverse, I have only a wave function renormalization of the photon to absorb it. You can see that if you have now a non-transverse guy, this can be absorbed, but you will need a wave function renormalization. You will need a mass kind of counter term for the photon, and you will need a change in the longitudinal, so you will need to renormalize your gauge fixing parameter. Which all sounds weird from point of view perturbation theory. I will finish on this and not write equations. The point is that when you analyze all the divergences you have in these functions, in other functions, yeah, what you find is that if you just power count and put the counter terms as I did last week, where you need to put them, what you find is that indeed you need four photon divergences like this. So in fact, in your effective action, you would need to renormalize this, you would need a graph like this. You will need this kind of guys. The point is, when you look at what you need to put, and you ask yourself, did I do something wrong? The answer is no. All the terms you put to renormalize the theory are consistent with the symmetry I wrote before. For instance, this term is g nu nu x x, g nu nu x x, some x, with a counter term. And g is not changed by the gauge symmetry. This term is gauge invariant. It's strange because we are not used to it, but no symmetry argument prohibits it. Yeah? What about this then? We had this for the scalar theory. Yeah? This would be bad because this would be A nu for the field, A nu times G nu nu. This is gauge invariant, but it's not. It turns out that you don't need this. And the reason is that you have all other world identities. When you exploit them, you find that, as usual, the gauge invariance of the theory, which now is more complicated if you wish, but it has the same role as before, where you would have some dangerous divergences. The world identity just tell you they are not there. For instance, this function was transverse, and the associated divergences are just not there. This guarantee that the divergences in that guy and in that guy are related in the way where the counter term I need is not many, but just one. Yeah? And et cetera, et cetera. And it goes the very same as usual. So the structure of the divergence is highly constrained by the gauge invariance of the theory. And the counter term you need are just those which are allowed by symmetry. So it turns out that this doesn't correspond to any divergence in the theory, and you don't need it. And the same. So at the end, you just have to write, it's the very same thing I wrote at the beginning of my discussion. You take your effective action and you write all the local counter terms which are consistent with the symmetry. And I'll finish with this. I give you some of them. One is delta z3 g mu nu d square minus d mu d nu applied on g mu nu x. Yeah, that's the usual thing you would expect. But you also have a counter term like delta m squared g mu mu xx. This is g mu mu, it's like a squared, but not in terms of A, but in terms of the connected guy. And this is allowed by the gauge invariant. The counter term is there, and the divergent and absorbed divergences. Another one would be delta xi, the change in the gauge fixing parameter, d mu, d nu, g mu nu, xx. This is allowed. And we have also this one. And you can have different possibilities of indices and just Lorentz invariance. The point is that if you put these counter terms which are allowed by symmetry, the statement is that you can get rid of all the divergence of the theory. In general, the old terms which are allowed by symmetry will be generated. That's the very same story as usual, but the constraints are different. Yeah. And for truncations, all this
works
if I find truncations which are gauge invariant. Yeah, take the basic truncation, this one. What happens? This line is the photon line, not changed by the gauge invariant. This one, what happens? It takes a phase E minus alpha here, a phase E plus alpha here. Same point, they disappear. Same happens here. This diagram is gauge invariant. And you can convince yourself that any diagram you can draw in QED is gauge invariant in that sense, which means that any truncation will have all these properties. And I stop here. And let's discuss the gauge fixing parameter dependence, which is next to the Sorry for the